All right, so here we go, guys. Today, I have the unbelievable pleasure of having Brian Wunsick, and I prepared some adjectives, and you'll see in a second why I've. So this is going to be a succulent treat, an appetizing tête-à-tête, a delicious conversation, a juicy chat. Now, why am I using all these adjectives? It's because Brian is probably the world leader of food psychology, certainly housed in a marketing department. Here's one of his books, his earlier books, bestseller, Mindless Eating, his more recent book, Slim by Design. He's got several other books, let me just mention them, Marketing Nutrition, Asking Questions, and Consumer Panels, and about another 100 published articles or so. So, Brian, why is it that you're not being sufficiently productive?
That's right. That's right. If I watch more TV, maybe I'd be able to turn it off a little bit. Yeah.
It's really great to see you. Thank you so much for coming on board.
Well, greetings from Oslo. I'm on sabbatical here in Oslo, Norway. Actually, working for it's kind of cool. I'm working with this organization for this year in sabbatical that looks at sustainability. It's called the EAT Initiative for Sustainability. And one of the big things we can deal with sustainability is what we eat and how much we eat and how much we throw away. So it's
Very nice. I was in Oslo 2 years ago. I was invited to
Oh,
speak
yeah.
at the is it Johan Arndt? I was giving a plenary at the Oslo School of Management, and I also gave a
Yeah.
talk to a consortium of Norwegian advertisers. Of course, I was talking about my evolutionary stuff,
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
yeah, I
yeah.
had a great time. So, how long are you there for? A year?
Yeah, for a full year here. So
Oh, wonderful.
already it's dark about 23 hours a day.
Okay. Right. That's almost literally true, right? It gets
It's
dark even
true.
earlier than in Ithaca, right?
That's right. That's
Right.
right.
Now, I wanted, you probably won't remember this because at the time, I think, well, not I think you were more senior than me, but the first time that I ever, I'm not even sure if we met, but that I saw you was at a Northeast Marketing Consortium.
Oh,
So,
sure.
I think it was in 1991. It was being held at MIT. I was, I think,
Yeah,
starting my
yeah.
second year. You were a young assistant professor at Dartmouth. And of course, I was this young little schmuck who just sat in a corner. Well, actually, that's not true. I never was very quiet.
I wouldn't be.
No, that's not true.
Yeah, I'm not believing that either.
But that's the first time that I saw it. I thought, wow, I mean, obviously, I thought you were a great role model to emulate, but who would know that you would explode? So maybe you could start by telling us a bit about your food research, and then I've specifically jotted down some of the studies that you've done that I thought were particularly cool. But maybe you
Oh.
could give us a quick summary of your work.
Yeah, cool. Well, so anyway, I grew up in Iowa, which is about the least coolest state to be from in all of the United States. But when I was there, it was kind of raised on a farm, and so I sold vegetables door to door in a little wagon, he's a little boy. And I always found it kind of interesting that because if you were to ask people, well, what differentiates people who like vegetables and people who don't, people would say, well, it's economic, or it's whatever, it's sociodemographic. And I'd find that I would stop at one house and they would buy all the vegetables I had. And
Right.
then I'd stop at the very next house, identical in every way, and they would look at me like I was dragging like kryptonite behind me. And I remember when I applied to PhD programs, which is oh, gee whiz, it's nearly 30 years ago now. I applied and said, I want to study why sometimes you clean your plate, sometimes you don't. Why sometimes you like vegetables when the person next to you doesn't.
Right.
And I'm sure they thought, what a lunatic. But that's for the last 25 years as a professor, and that's all I've studied is the psychology of eating behavior,
Right.
all oriented toward trying to get people to eat better.
Right. I have a Psychology Today blog, and in
Yeah,
several instances,
it's a great
oh,
blog.
you thank you, you're very kind. It's almost impossible to not always look to your research for inspiration for one of my Psychology Today articles, because I really think, and I'm not blowing smoke up your proverbial behind, I really think that you've got the right mix of work that is obviously theoretically, methodologically sound, that's has great societal impact, but that also passes the wow, that's cool, right? No, but it's true. And so in that sense, it becomes easy to write about your research because everybody can so clearly relate to all of the ultimate findings that you get, right? And so here I'd like to very, very quickly mention that there's a great paper, which I'm probably, you know, there's a philosophy of science paper that many doctoral students have to read called That's Interesting. Do you know that paper?
No, I don't.
Oh, I gotta send you the link to it.
Cool.
And in that paper, the author in question basically enumerates a list of criteria that, if you like, have to be met, at least one of them have to be met for the research to pass the That's Interesting criteria.
Oh, that's great.
And so I think your work definitely passes on one, if not many of them. And I think that oftentimes, and we could talk about that later, oftentimes marketing academics are great methodologists. Oh, hi there.
A little later, okay.
See, that's a natural slice of life. See,
that's right.
But I was gonna say, so a lot of times I think marketing scholars, and you tell me if you agree with it, mm-hmm. are so focused on methodology that they lose sight of the fact that, you know, is the ultimate problem interesting or not?
Later, please. Thank you. Yeah, no, I think so. Yeah, and you know what? I think one thing, I don't know who the academic is who wrote that,
right?
But I think we all have things that sort of curse us, and I've always been kind of afraid of being boring at right. parties or being boring in other places. And I think a person who has that fear, I think sometimes kind of goes the extra mile to make sure that things are more engaging. I mean, when I've read all of your research in the past, it all has, it's like you're listening to somebody tell this really cool story.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, and so you're sort of trying to avoid being boring. In my case, I mean, I think we could link it. My driving ethos is I'm incredibly intellectually curious, right? I mean, I just want to navigate through as many landscapes as I can because the world is full of wonder. And so in a sense, that's been difficult sometimes to navigate amongst my marketing colleagues who are unfortunately very much, you know, stifled by particular silos and paradigms and methodologies. And of course, from a careerist perspective, you know, that's what you should do. Nail down your paradigm and then churn out 3,000 studies that are plus epsilon more. And I don't mean to chastise folks who do that. That's certainly a good strategy to be successful. In my case, you know, I thought, you know, life is short. I'm certainly always going to be true to pursuing hopefully good science, but I'm going to go where the interesting problems are. And in a second later, I'm going to just list some of the journal articles where you've published. And that's exactly to me a CV that I love. A guy who is all over the place, who's contributing to many fields. Yes, you contribute in the great marketing journals, but you also go all over the place. So maybe I can ask you, is it the fact that you study food that drove your interdisciplinarity, or is it that you are a committed interdisciplinarian and then you studied food, you know, as a consequence?
You know, that's a great question because I think one thing that happens if a person's fairly practical, you kind of say, wow, you know, I ran into this really important question that needs to be answered, whatever it is. You know, are we aware of when we're full or not? And so, oh, I got a really cool way to test that. I got a neat way to do it. And like you and me, if you say, I've got a cool idea that I want to pursue, the heck with what the journal is, I'll finish the article and then I'll find a home for it.
Right.
I think that's different. There's a number of great colleagues who are really incredibly published who start off by saying, how could I get this topic to fit in one of the three best journals? And if they can't see a path for it, they kind of go, bah, then I'll do something else.
Right. Now, do you think that there is a way for us to alter that reflex in marketing? Because I think ultimately, it causes people, as you said, to maybe shy away from pursuing problems if they don't fit within those three, four marketing journals that young assistant professors are supposed to publish in. So how do we get around that problem? How do we get people to say, yes, of course, those journals are important, but pursue interesting problems? Is it just a matter of inculcating that in them as doctoral students?
Yeah, well, you know, I think there's a couple things that can do that can be done. Is first of all, I think labeling it. So this new journal coming out, it's called the Journal of the Association for Consumer Research. We're editing, and in a case like that, I'm very specifically labeling this kind of research as boundary research,
right?
Because it's at the boundary of you know, evolutionary psychology and what we do, or these other boundaries. And I think by specifically labeling this boundary research, and then also I very clearly say almost many types of research that are really central to a discipline often started off as like weirdo boundary stuff.
Yes.
You know, whether it be, you know, the diffusion of innovation or diffusion theory or whatever. It started off really at the edge, and then it kind of moved in. So labeling something as on the boundary and not weirdo,
right,
I think this helps.
Right.
The second thing is promotion and tenure of people who do this research. And one thing that I've got this article coming out in the Journal of Consumer Behavior next year, and it's called Boundary Research. And one of the things I talk about is this thing that I've worked on with colleagues I've had who also do kind of this off-kilter stuff. And the idea is coming up with a research impact matrix.
Yes.
Okay. And so the thing is, in research impact matrix, is it's not just like, well, how many articles, you know, the 10 articles you have before you come up for tenure and the impact factor, but saying, you know, there's a lot of different definitions of impact. One is, okay, the quality of the journal. One is the number of citations it has, whether that be, you know, wherever, Google Scholar, whatever. The number of times it gets downloaded from SSRN or whatever.
Okay.
But there's another kind of impact, and that's the sort of outreach it gets, the number of paper requests you have, the number of times it's mentioned in the media. And that's a third type of impact. And then the fourth impact is if it changes something somewhere else, but you usually don't see that in the first few years. But by coming up with a specific matrix, all of a sudden you can equivalent an article in the Journal of Market Research with the Journal of Pediatrics.
Exactly.
Because you have a lot of comms do it. And I hope that's a tool that helps.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'd love to see that paper. Maybe you can send me a copy of it.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, there is a service right now, maybe you're already aware of this, called Altmetric. Are you familiar with that?
I use it. Yeah.
Oh, you use it. Okay, so there you go. And I think a lot of our marketing colleagues, I mean, now they're starting to kind of find out about it. But because I published in sort of non-traditional, non-marketing journals, I was sort of aware of this metric, maybe ahead of some of our marketing colleagues. And I mean, listen, it's exactly what you said, right? I mean, if you've got a paper that scores in the 99th percentile of, I mean, who gives a damn? I mean, right? We are in the business of doing two things, right? We produce memes, we produce ideas, and then we disseminate ideas. And so, you know, that's the business that you and I are in. So yes, if you could publish it in JCR and that's how you can disseminate it, wonderful. If you could write a book, you know, for example, book writing was often viewed within our field with derision, right? I mean, no, you only publish in it. But how could that be? So On the Origin of Species by Charles Darwin is a book. Well, God damn it, Charles, no tenure for you, boy. You didn't publish in Journal of Marketing, right? So the idea is, you know, we have to get past these fast and frugal heuristics where you come up with these, you know, ridiculous metrics in judging people. Judge them by the importance of the work that they do. And if it has impact, then they're doing a great job. And I mean, I look at your Google Scholar Index. I hope to have that index when I retire. Holy moly, you're getting cited a lot.
It's kind of unpredictable. But I like we said about books, there's a kind of a funny joke that I can only remember one part of, but it's like, you know, why wouldn't God get tenure?
Yes.
Well, the answer is that he only published one book and no articles.
Exactly. That's very good. I'm going to steal that. That from now on, I will remember that as my own. I wanted to get into some of your outlandishly, if I may say, sexy research. Now, I don't know if I should describe it, or rather, it's your research. Maybe you should describe it. So maybe I'll just state them, and then you could tell me about them if you remember them. If not, I'll fill in. There's one that I loved, which I wrote on my Psychology Today blog: the Chinese buffet study. Do you remember that one? Love it. Give me the top two, three findings. I have a few in mind, but give me some of yours.
So, you know, there's all these people who say, you know, we should ban buffets because, you know, people can't control themselves and they're bozos. So we need to control the eat. We need to ban buffets, or we need to, you know, tax them, or we need to, you know, outlaw them. But what it doesn't explain is why are at least half the people eat at buffets really skinny people? I mean, what do they know that heavy people don't know? Right. And so, but we thought, well, you can't ask people, because if you ask them, they kind of go, if you say, what do you do different than a heavy person? They go, I don't know. So one of the things we did is we went and we watched and coded about 320 or 40 people change their face, see what they did differently than heavy people. One thing they do, there's five key things they do. One thing is they scout out the buffet before they pick up their plate. About two-thirds of them look at all the food and then they get the plate. 70% of all heavy people do the opposite. They go straight for the plate.
I'm that guy, so I already fail. Fail number one.
That's right. Another thing that that skinny people tend to do is they tend to sit on average about 5 meters away, farther away from the buffet than the typical heavy person. They're three times as likely to face away from the food. They're eight times more likely to get a smaller plate than a bigger plate if there's both size plates. And they're more likely to use chopsticks. So it's great. I mean, you've got, even though it's causal and not correlational, my Cornell Food and Brand Lab, we have a saying, if you want to be skinny, you do what skinny people do. Why tempt fate?
True. Very good. Love it. Next one. Oh, this one was really cute. When you did a content analysis of recipe books across longitudinal, and of course you came up with the fact that there was a huge... I mean, how did you think about doing that study? I mean, see, that's what I love about your stuff, right? And this, the first one is an observational study, field observation. Second one is a content analysis. Maybe you could talk about this one a bit.
Yeah, well, you know, if you look at in public health, there's a lot of people and a lot of critics say, you know, the reason we're obese, it's because of the food industry. It's because they're making us fat. It's restaurants making us fat, and they all blame fast food and stuff. And you say, really, you know, yeah, there are more fast food restaurants than there were 40 years ago, but has what we eat at home changed? And you can't ask your great grandmother because she's dead. But what you can do, if books end up, especially successful books, end up being sort of a bellwether of the times, we can see what serving sizes and calorie levels were back then versus now. So we did this with a bunch of books, but the sexiest of those books was, we looked at The Joy of Cooking. Right. And we looked at the first issue of The Joy of Cooking, like 1936. And we looked at the ninth issue, which was 2006. And I feel bad about this, but we had people figure out all the calories of all the food proportion in 1936 compared to today. And we found that... If you look at the similar foods that were there, now they have 44% more calories per serving.
Incredible.
Than they did back then.
Holding volume constant.
Yeah, well, in two-thirds of the cases, it's because, exactly, it's what you say, two-thirds of the cases, it's because just additional ingredients, more butter, more sugar, more raisins, nuts, more meat. But the other third is a change in servings
size
per servings. Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
So it's really cool. I mean, and the great news you can use is, you say, holy cow, if the stuff I'm making is almost twice the size of what our grandmothers made, maybe what we should do is we should make it, cut it in half, and put half in the refrigerator to start with, and not put it all in front of us.
Which, by the way, I tell you a quick personal anecdote. So we often, you know, I lived in California for a few years. I was at UC Irvine, and I have family there, so every summer we go back there. And the reason I'm saying this is because whenever we go back to California, we end up going, you know, maybe once a week to the Cheesecake Factory. The serving sizes are, for one serving size, one plate, can easily meet the daily caloric requirement of a Russian battalion, guaranteed. and so even someone like me, who doesn't shy away from food, I simply can't finish it. So usually when we go, we have two children and my wife and I, we usually only order two plates, and we end up taking some food home, which really speaks to how outlandishly big the portion sizes are. I mean, I see it whenever I travel from Canada to the US. I mean, it's just instantaneous, right? I mean, everything gets bigger, not just the people, but the food size. I mean, right? Have you ever done studies comparing specifically Canada to the US in terms of that issue, in terms of the average portion size at a restaurant or something like that?
No, I haven't. That's interesting. But you know, one of the things I started doing a while back is anytime we do a study that has a sort of a representative sample component, we do the same thing in the U.S., and then I make sure that 25% of the sample is also Canadian.
Oh, right.
And that way, you know, we can kind of speak to a broader group of people and stuff.
Well, yeah, have you heard of this bias? I think the acronym is WEIRD. Have you heard of that? The WEIRD bias?
I'm not sure.
No, WEIRD, WEIRD stands for Western Educated. I can't remember the rest of it. I discussed it in one of my forthcoming papers. But it basically refers to the fact that in the behavioral sciences, we too often, of course, succumb to, you know, I'm a professor of psychology at Ohio State University. I run it with my undergrads, and then that's it. I can generalize. Now, in some cases, if you're studying a general cognitive process that should be transportable around the world, that makes sense. But in other cases, of course, it doesn't. And incidentally, the group of folks who succumb least to the WEIRD bias are evolutionary psychologists, precisely because they're studying typically human universals that necessitate a testing of the phenomenon across many different cultures. And so I have an invited piece in JMR where I'm now working on the revision, where I sort of talk about these issues, some of the sort of endemic challenges in the social sciences and behavioral sciences, and how, frankly, evolutionary psychology certainly ameliorates the conditions for some of these issues. So hopefully the paper gets through and you'll enjoy it.
But let's, I love it. Yeah, it's great.
Let's go on to the third one. Here we go. This might be the granddaddy of them all. Last meals of death row inmates. Go.
Oh, come on. I can't believe you're bringing these up.
How the hell did you think up of that one? That's unbelievable.
This is crazy. So, the world is filled with people who are experts and can pontificate and make these grand statements about things. And I always love it when people talk about these discussions. And I'm a real foodie, and I think my wife's in the back. She went to Le Cordon Bleu Paris. And
impressive.
So, you know, I love great food. But I always love these people who very pompously talk about what their last meal would be. It's like, well, my last meal, what it would be if I had one more meal left. It's just like, you know, really, you can't say that with confidence.
Right.
You know, first of all, most people don't know what their last meal is going to be. You know, I mean, when you hit the iceberg or whenever, what happens.
Right.
But the one weird group of people, not only weird, but I mean, the one unfortunate group of people who do know their last meal are people on death row. And we said, okay, well, let's see what real people eat for their last meal when they do know it's their last meal. And so, for a five-year period, we took all the people in the United States who were executed, and the interesting thing, it's maybe our morbid
fascination.
Country.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Is that every newspaper in Texas or South Carolina or Iowa or whatever will say what the person's last meal was.
Right.
You know, because I'll give it a little. So we went and collected all this data, and then we coded it. And you know, it's kind of interesting. I had this girl, doing a wonderful girl from Illinois, who had been in my lab for like 3 years, and she just got increasingly not herself. And at one time, I said, "Becky, how are things going? Are things okay?" And she goes, "You know," she goes, "Yeah," but she goes, "I have a real hard time doing this because I'm getting depressed." So it's like, you know, good point. So we found some other people to finish it up.
Wow.
And we found a bunch of interesting things. But I mean, one thing we ended up finding is that the average calories in that last meal ended up being about three times more than the average calories a person needs during a day.
Right.
They really, really eat. But one of the things that we found that was very strange is there's something called the last meal test of innocence. And
right.
And it's, you know, the thing that, well, if you're innocent, and you're wrongly being executed, you don't eat a last meal because in your subconsciously you're not acknowledging that that you did anything. So so we took a look at all these different people and said that some people who said I'm sorry or I'm guilty. That's one group. Some people that said and there are some people, other people who said you know I'm innocent, and some who say nothing. And we looked at the two groups. And if people said they're innocent, we don't know whether they were or not. Right. Say they're innocent. They ate like half as many calories, as the people who were guilty. They ate a whole lot healthier, which is crazy. Yeah. And you were less likely to eat desserts. It was
just incredible, right? I mean, you're first of all, you're finding, you know, unbelievably creative data source, right? I mean, who would think? I mean, I almost should have you committed to a psychiatric institute for coming up with such data, or at least pursuing such data. But then to then use the moderator of my stated innocence or and guilt as determining whether I eat more or less calories, absolutely brilliant. Of course, folks who are watching this can either go and check out the original study by Brian. I also discuss his work on my Psychology Today blog. You can check it out. Let's go to the next one. Oh, this one I love. Now, this one I love because it's straight up my evolutionary psychology area. And I actually cite this paper in a book chapter. So I was asked to write.
Oh, good.
I was asked to write. Do you know who David Buss is?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so
yeah,
David Buss is one of the pioneers of evolutionary psychology.
He is.
He asked me to write the chapter on evolutionary consumer psychology in the Handbook of Evolutionary Psychology, and I think it was in that book chapter that I discussed the next study that we're going to talk about of yours. And I remember when he was sort of going through the editing of the, he wrote something like, "Oh, cool! I didn't know this finding." Something like, "I was like, damn! If I impress David Buss, I'm on the right track." And I've got you to thank because you're the one who came up with the study. So here it goes: greater jealousy induced when sharing meal with an ex. Now that's all evolutionary stuff, baby. You know that.
It is, and that is with that. I did that with a very brilliant anthropologist. His name's Kevin Niffen.
And I know him very well.
He's a real dude. I really every paper I do with him, he's amazing to work with. And there we went. Look, this is the deal. So
why are you looking back to see if your wife is listening?
That's right. Well, so this is kind of the origin of that paper. So I had this guy who was a postdoc, and he was from Brigham Young University, and just a really smart, hardworking guy. And then I had somebody else who kind of worked with me, who's I'd known her from Illinois, and she's very pretty and very nice and stuff. And I was going to go out of town one day, and I said, "Well, why don't you guys kind of just, I'm not going to be able to make it to lunch. Why don't you guys just have lunch and talk about this?" I get back a couple days later, and I said, "Oh, hey, what did you guys decide at lunch?" He goes, "No, I don't do that. I don't go eat lunch." I go, "Why?" Well, he says, "Because it's with the single woman, and I don't like the way that looks." And I kind of went, I get it, but it didn't even dawn on me, and so that's why I wrote this paper.
Amazing. What's beautiful about that anecdote is that it shows how just by being open to daily exchanges, that could serve as a source for some future, right? I mean, because one of the things that everybody would be interested in knowing is, you know, how do academics come up with their ideas? Well, look at this one, right? It was an innocuous little moment that sort of triggered an idea. I've got a great story that links up to this from a TV show, and I talk about this in one of my books, The Consuming Instinct. I don't know if you remember the TV show King of Queens.
Yeah, it's about something in New York City.
Exactly. There's a sort of a portly guy who drives like he's a courier, truck driver or courier driver. And at one point, he becomes friends with this woman who's a chef. He's very happily married. You know, he's not cheating on his wife. But this woman with whom he becomes friends, since she's a chef, she starts preparing him all sorts of foods, and they're speaking on the phone about the food. And his wife goes into sort of this insane jealousy fit. And I'm going to link it to evolutionary psychology in a second. And she basically says, you know what, I mean, you're cheating on me. And he goes, what are you talking about? I'm cheating. I'm not cheating on you. I didn't have sex with her and so on. And of course, from her perspective, in terms of female psychology, the fact that that they were developing an emotional bond, in this case revolving around food, was triggering her emotional infidelity, which links us back to a classic study by David Buss and his colleagues back in 1992, where they had elicited, where they had triggered either emotional or sexual infidelity in people. So like they got people to imagine their long-term partners either engaging in emotional infidelity, you know, you're hanging out with your coworker and you get along nicely and she laughs at your jokes, or you get your or you get the participants to think of a sexual infidelity. Your wife is having sex right now with the gorgeous Greek gardener, okay? And so they tied them with all this physiological apparatus so that they could measure their stress response, because of course it makes it more difficult to lie, if not impossible. And of course what they found, which is exactly what you predict from the evolutionary perspective, men had a much more strong reaction to sexual infidelity, women more to emotional infidelity. Yeah. For men, so the evolutionary argument is very simple. Men's greatest threat is paternity uncertainty. And so if a woman, if your woman goes with another man, that triggers this very serious genetic problem. On the other hand, for women, the greatest threat to her reproductive interest is if a man leaves the union, removes his investment from the union. And the greater predictor of that is if the man develops an emotional bond with another woman. Now, that doesn't mean that women like it if you have sex with other women, and it doesn't mean that men like it if you emotionally cheat on them, but it was interesting to see that the patterns were different, and only through an evolutionary analysis were you able to then explain this very granular finding. So there you go.
That's really cool. That's really cool.
Oh, good.
It reminds me of that phrase, mother, baby, father, maybe.
Exactly right. That's paternity uncertainty. I actually have a paper that went through several rounds of review in a top marketing journal, and now it's kind of a bit in a limbo state where the sort of the key punchline of the paper is how gift-giving practices at weddings are such that the maternal side of the bride and groom give larger gifts than the paternal side, precisely because there is no such thing as maternity uncertainty, but there is such a thing as paternity uncertainty.
Interesting.
The findings could not be any clearer. The findings could not be any more elegant and clean, if I may say. But you know how it goes with some of these journals. So now we're trying to see if we can get it through. Wish us luck. Let's go on to the next one. Yeah. Well,
that's like I guess that's why guys don't have baby showers too.
right, exactly. But by the way, when a baby is born, just for you to know, when a baby, and I talked about this actually recently in a talk I gave in Mexico, when a baby is born, usually people say that he looks exactly like the father, especially the mother's side of the family, right? and incidentally, objectively speaking, there is no way that the baby looks like anything at that point. I mean, morphologically speaking, but it's a means to implement, if you like, a cultural norm to assuage the fear of paternity uncertainty, right? We didn't evolve with DNA paternity tests. Now, here's the kicker. And some of the viewers might have seen me talk about this before in a lecture. So when my wife was pregnant with our first child, Luna, you know, you get the customary first ultrasound images in the first trimester. We put them up on the fridge. And it's just an image of the ultrasound, right? I mean, you can't tell whether that ultrasound is an amoeba, is a virus, is an extraterrestrial, is a gerbil. You don't know anything. My mother-in-law comes over, stops, and says, "Oh my God, Gad, the baby looks exactly like you." I said, "Should I be worried? Because you're trying to really convince me that my wife didn't cheat on me." She said, "What do you think?" So, but that shows you the power of evolutionary theory. So there you go. Now this next one I love. This is the having less colors versus more colors of, say, a candy. I always, by the way, use that example in my lectures, of course, and I cite your work. I think it was published in JCR, if I'm not mistaken.
Can
you maybe talk a bit about that one a bit? I love it because it speaks to the variety effect.
Yeah, so there's a lot of it. So this is with Barbara Kahn, who's at Wharton. She's a wonderful co-author.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
I think she's probably 58 or 60 now and works as hard as an assistant professor does.
Sorry.
And there's all these people that are out there kind of go, and I'm not kidding, there are people that have published 50 papers showing that, you know, the more variety of yogurt you have, the more you eat. And that's just shouldn't be surprising to, you know, a five-year-old, right? Because the more variety you have, the more you're likely to find something you like stronger. And we thought, well, you know, is it variety that actually makes you eat more, or is it just the perception of variety? So if we could manipulate how much variety people think they're seeing, are they going to, would they eat more? And so we did this in a bunch of cases, but the one case that seems to stick with people is M&Ms. We gave people, you know, six colors of M&Ms that were all organized, or you gave them six colors of M&Ms that were all different. And if it was all different, they ate like 40% more M&Ms, even though these silly things taste the same. But then we said, but what happens if it looks like way too much variety? Do people just freak out? And this is back when you could buy lots of colors of M&Ms, like at an M&M store. Maybe you still can. So we did the same study, but we had 24 colors of M&Ms that were either organized or they're all mixed together. We found there, if they're all mixed together, people go, oh my God, this is like chaos.
Right, right.
And they at some point, there's too much variety.
Right. And there's another study. So if you compare, say, singular color M&M versus multiple color M&Ms, you'd expect that even though the colorant is tasteless and odorless, people will consume more from the multicolored. There's another study that I found when I'm discussing in a lecture, say, this variety effect. So I'll use some of your color M&M stuff. But there's another one which you may or may not know of that was done, which speaks to the same effect, where you manipulate the shape of pasta. So you eat.
Oh yeah,
you know that one?
Yeah. That's neat.
So singular. This is by the guy, I think, Rolls and Rowe. They're the food psychologists, I think, out of Oxford University, or University of Oxford, and basically they manipulate. So it's the same pasta, so it doesn't taste different, but they either have it in one shape or whatever it was. I don't remember. They say four shapes, and of course, people then end up gorging a lot more from the four-shaped presentation. Right now, of course. The way that I, in the context of when I present it, I then argue that, well, so why do we succumb to the variety effect? And then, of course, here's where you could introduce an evolutionary argument as to why the variety effect is so alluring to us, even in contexts like these where we shouldn't be succumbing to it. And of course, the guy who proposed the original argument, which of course you would certainly know very well, is Paul Rosen. Which he basically argued.
He's a stud. He's great.
Actually, I was communicating with him once, and we chatted at length at a recent SCP conference, and you know, it gave me great solace to know that even the great Paul Rosen gets something like 80% of his papers rejected.
That's right.
I was like pissed about something, and we were communicating, and he goes, "Oh, you know, don't worry about it, kid. I get 80% of my papers rejected." I'm like, "All right, well, Paul Rosen gets rejected, I'm okay." So, anyways, he basically argues that, you know, one of the evolutionary reasons for succumbing to the variety effect is that it is a risk diversification strategy for not being exposed to one food source that might be tainted, right? So in the same way that, say, in finance, you have a diversified risk portfolio to mitigate your risk, that's what you're really doing with sampling multiple food sources. And so that's a way where you could take some of the variety effect stuff that you're doing and then say, well, what would be the ultimate, the Darwinian explanation for these effects that you so cleverly demonstrate? Which kind of leads me to my next point. And I think you and I have been wanting to collaborate for years. And I'm still holding your feet to the fire that we got to do some good stuff together. But I think it speaks to, you know, someone like you and me can get together and we're not contradicting one another's work, right? You do great work at the proximate level. You're explaining the mechanism, the how, the what, and I can come along and then hopefully contribute, among other things, a evolutionary lens to the phenomenon in question. So the Darwinian why, which is the ultimate explanation, along with the proximate how and what, then work together to offer a complete solution. And it's taken me years, you know, as somebody who started the field of evolutionary consumption, as you might imagine, a lot of marketing colleagues have been historically quite hostile to my work. I mean, they're starting to come around. But for a very long time, they didn't really appreciate this distinction, that introducing biology and evolutionary psychology need not imply that your paradigm is dead. It simply means that I am studying something at a different epistemological level, and together we'll have a better explanation for the phenomenon, right? So when I've always looked at your work, I've always thought, you know, that's the kind of guy that I might be able to work with to sort of introduce a lot of these evolutionary ideas. Because first of all, food, it's so easy to link up to basic Darwinian mechanisms. And of course, you've got such an uncanny ability to come up with all sorts of clever ways to test these things at the proximate level. All we need is to add the ultimate and, you kill the thing, you know? So,
well, I've got a cool example about that. So we did something a while back. We were trying to figure out what can we do, let's say as parents, to get kids to eat vegetables or foods they wouldn't otherwise eat. Is there a way that we can set up a plate things out so that it makes kids eat more of the food? It's probably not doing it the way we do it, because we're adults looking at food, but you know, how do you break in two or more piles? What do you do? And one of the things we found is that we did a bunch of things, brought kids in. We found that kids, if food was touching, they'd just go ape bonkers, and they didn't want to eat any foods that were even just touching. And so, you know, that's kind of interesting. And in trying to explain why, you'd say, well, maybe because if peas and carrots mix, they like one better than worse than the other. But, you know, I talked to an evolutionary psychologist this is Kevin Niffen, brilliant, yes, brilliant man. And he said, well, maybe another explanation is that if you are a caveman and all your food's mixed together, you eat and you get violently sick, you're going to have an aversion to every single food pot. And I thought, God, that is brilliant, because that's a much better explanation than my lame explanation.
Right. Well, but I mean, that's a wonderful example, because it demonstrates that there is a additional layer of epistemological explanations that are afforded to you by coming from an adaptationist perspective, right? It's sort of like saying, you know, until you had the electronic microscope as an actual apparatus, there were things that you simply couldn't study because you were bound by the tools of right? In this case, the tool is not the electronic microscope, it's an epistemological tool. And that's really the whole point of the JMR invited piece that I'm writing, is that when you talk about the methods of EP, it's not that the actual methodology is different, right? It's not that, I mean, evolutionary psychologists use experiments and they use field observations and they use surveys. So it's not as though there are mysterious different methods that evolutionary psychologists use. It's that epistemologically, that's where their methodology is different, is that they ask questions at a different level of analysis. And that's the contribution that hopefully, I still hope that, you know, eventually this will become normal science, where all consumer psychologists may not be evolutionary psychologists, right? But at least they will be aware of the additional explanatory power that they could afford to get to if they wish to, right? And so I think by sort of, in my experience, by sort of revising the delivery of my message, I've been able to convince people, because I think a lot of times what happens is that people build up these paradigmatic defenses, right? If biology boy comes in, then we're screwed, right? No, but that's really, I mean, they didn't say those words, but that's really what's happening, that's right, funny. There, right? And the reality is, no. I mean, you know, you're not going to be out of a job because an evolutionist offers an ultimate explanation. On the contrary, together you simply succeed more, right? And so I think that message is maybe starting to become a bit more, it's starting to resonate more with folks. So let's see. We'll know soon. What else have I got? Let me see. Oh, we talked about interdisciplinarity. Oh, here's a good one. So it kind of builds on what I just said. So recently, a very good friend of mine, we both know, and I think probably both respect, and he was actually my cohort when I was coming out on the market, Michel Pham.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Very good. You know, I actually just had dinner, and I just had dinner on Monday with Luke Warlop, who was...
Oh, yeah, sure, of course.
And so we went up, and I ate, for the first time, we went to a famous Norwegian restaurant. I ordered half of a sheep's head and ate half of a sheep's head with Luke. Yeah, so it's,
wow, impressive. wow.
Once. He didn't eat it because he only eats fish.
Yeah. Luke or Michel?
Luke.
Oh, Luke, okay. So, yeah, because I think their connection is maybe that they're both originally from Florida. Belgium. Oh, Florida. Okay.
Oh, yeah, and they're both from Belgium.
Well, exactly. So anyway, so Michel Pham, he's a fantastic guy, not only as a scholar, but just a gentleman, just a lovely guy. He wrote a paper in 2013 in JCP, The Seven Sins of
Consumerism. I love that paper.
Isn't that fantastic?
I cite it all the time. Well, yeah,
not only that, not only I cite it in all my stuff, for example, the invited piece in JMR and so on, but I always use it now in my doctoral courses because what it basically does is you've got here the president of SCP at the time who's being honest and saying that look, of course we do great stuff and of course people are great methodologists and experimentalists and they do good important stuff, but we also have to be honest that we're not doing well in many areas. Now I just happen to be somebody who speaks very bluntly sometimes to a fault. That for many years when I would criticize things, people would get upset. But it was kind of nice to have the president of SCP, publish in a big forum. here are seven things we need to improve, which you probably remember some of them. So could you comment? Obviously, you're also one of the sort of prominent people in the field. Could you comment either on his seven sins or others that if there are doctoral students now listening, they could say, you know what? Okay, I'm gonna heed that advice. What are some of the sort of endemic things that we're facing that we could improve on as a field?
I think the big thing is not having, a practical solution that is a practical independent variable to answer theoretical solutions. So I'll give you an example. This person, I was talking to a doctoral student a while back, and he wants to look at this idea that when you are in a precarious situation, you have a very short time horizon and not a long time horizon.
Okay.
Like he's from Iceland and he's looking at if you're walking on ice, you have a very short time horizon, you're thinking not a long time horizon. It's like, oh, well that's kind of interesting. He's got a really cool way that he makes people walk where it's really unsteady. And I said, well, how are you look at time horizons? He goes, well, in the traditional way, like, whether you take one gamble for, I don't know.
Oh, right. The discounting stuff, right?
Are you high? I said, nobody who's fearing for their life is doing math problems. That is crazy.
Right.
I said, why don't you do something else? Like have them in this precarious situation decide whether they're going to, go to a healthy restaurant or a less healthy restaurant or ask them what they plan and what they'd rather eat or something that has real relevance because nobody's doing. And he goes, well, that's not the way that's measured. Right. And then it's just like, you don't have to do something so weird and artificial.
Right.
But he couldn't get out of the
right
mindset.
Right.
That there's an interesting dependent variable out there that would be easier to study.
Well, I think so to kind of add to what you're saying.
Relevant.
Right. There's a wonderful term. It was Sternberg and Grigorenko in a paper in American Psychologist 2001, which I originally cited in my first book, The Evolution of Racism and Consumption, where they introduced the word methodological fixation. And I love that word, right? I mean, it's the old, if you have a hammer, the whole world looks like it's made up of nails or whatever that expression
right,
is.
Right, I love it. Right? I love it.
So regrettably, now, I don't know if it is specific to our field. Probably it replicates in other fields as well. Most people are astonishingly succumbing to methodological fixation, right? So if you're a priming guy, the world can only be studied through priming. Now, look at the studies that we discussed that you've done. Every possible methodology, right? I mean, you have an interesting problem, then the data, then you think about, well, what is the data that I need to study that? But really, that's not at all how marketing doctoral students are trained. I mean, the first thing you do is, am I a quant guy or am I a behavioral guy? And then once that branch starts, now we start coming up with ever more granular methodological, if you like, branches within the tree of methodology. And then by the end of it, I am known as the priming guy in studying the elaboration likelihood model. So the whole world is only about this. Wrong, right? I mean, that's not the way you do truly impactful science. Get out of this fixation. Look for interesting problems, and then the tools that are needed to solve that problem will manifest themselves, right?
I had a really neat experience once when I was a PhD student. I used to kind of like Nathan, maybe run around the track a little bit. And there was always another professor. He was a professor. He's an assistant professor who's up for tenure, and we knew he wasn't going to get tenure because he only had one publication. It was a great publication, but we knew he wasn't going to get tenure. But he got tenure, and we didn't realize that. But he had a pipeline about 7 miles long,
right.
And he was also a great colleague. But the one paper, and actually all the papers he had after that, were very, very impactful because they were extremely creative. Like, he would look at market equilibrium based on how many laundromats were in the yellow pages for different sized towns.
Wow.
I mean, crazy cool stuff. And I remember I asked him once, I'd been an idiot as a PhD student, and we were running around the track. I said, he just got tenure. I said, oh, congratulations on getting tenure. And I said something like, why do you think you ever got tenure with only one article? You know, that's how.
Right.
And I was amazed at what he said. He says two words. He says, cool data.
Right. Wow, beautiful story.
And ever since then, I was trying to think, I think my dissertation had kind of cool data, but I always thought, what's the most vivid way that I could make a story? So let's say this goes back to the fear of being boring at parties,
right.
And stuff. Is that, you know, if somebody comes up and you say, what do you do? It's like, well, I do MTurk studies. Let me tell you about them. And she's like,
right.
You know, and I think it's the idea of saying, what is the most graphic way I could probably mention this?
Right.
Or make it compelling? And I think that's, I mean, with refillable soup bowl, the original thing wasn't a refillable soup bowl in restaurants. The original thing was we would have people choose how much they wanted to eat. And then when we'd bring it to them, we'd just add more to it.
Right.
And that's pretty lame.
Right.
But, you know, trying to say, well, that's not going to make anybody excited, but a refillable soup bowl.
Yeah, right. That's sexy. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
Now, here's another one for you. I mean, what we're doing right here is something that, of course, not many academics do with much regret, and that is engage in public outreach. I mean, one of the things that, you know, I love about my job. I mean, I love pretty much all facets. I love doing the basic science. I like communicating the basic science. I like chatting about ideas. I mean, I do it all because I'm just somebody who's constantly intellectually excited about everything. How do we get our colleagues, now this is not something that's only endemic to marketing academics, you know, how do we get them to appreciate the value of being active in reaching out to the public, right? It's not only about publishing in your specialized journals, which only 18 people will read or care about. It's also about going to hopefully 50,000 people out there and getting them excited. What are the obstacles and how do we get around that?
I mean, that's another really, really great question. And I think one thing is, you say, what would be their incentive to do it? Well, most of them, and most of my best friends, even my co-authors, I think they'd almost have a hard time telling a story about papers in a way that really would make any difference because there's no punchline is what somebody should do differently. There's no insight into their personal behavior. There's no real implication. And so in some ways, I can't blame them for being not outreach very oriented.
Right.
And I think a lot of things, and I never realized this about professors, but many of the people I went to school with, they came from very, if not rich backgrounds, at least high socioeconomic backgrounds with lots of education. And in some ways, kind of the reaching out wasn't really something that they did, unlike, you know, maybe us when I'm at Thanksgiving on the farm and people are saying, well, what exactly do you do?
Right.
You know, you don't want to say, well, let me tell you about my last MTurk study.
Right.
And that's one thing. And then another thing is I had a conversation once, and this is analogous. I had a friend when I was at the University of Illinois, and I know he was a really, really great friend. And he spent time with research, but he really mailed it in when it came to teaching. He didn't really put any time into it, you know. And I remember for a long time trying to convince him that he should invest more time in teaching, and you know, because that's important too. And he just did not, they don't pay me to do that. And I came to this realization. I think I mentioned this to my wife back then, my frustration, and she said something like, "Why are you so frustrated?" She says, if everybody worked as hard at teaching as they did research, there wouldn't be anything special about you who try to do both.
Right, right.
And I kind of, and at the point, I'm like, you know, that's right. I am not talking about anymore to him. And I've tried to convince people about this outreach for a long time. And now I say, you know, I try to develop it with my students and my postdocs. But if other people aren't coming along, well, that makes our contribution all the much,
that much
greater.
True. I think so. I guess there are two issues. I mean, you'd like to think that people will develop the intrinsic motivation to want to do the outreach, but to the extent that, as you're correctly saying, many of them might not have that intrinsic drive to do the outreach, then maybe the solution would be to create reward systems that give you, you know, extrinsic motivation to be doing the outreach. And you're starting to see that. So for example, when you're applying for grants, and I think, you know, you're a guy who gets a lot of grants and so on, they now will specifically ask about, you know, what kind of impact has this had in the outside world, right? Not just amongst, you know, your seven colleagues who read your papers, but it's, you know, what's the buzz, right? What's the meme? No, I'm not denigrating. I'm being serious, right? What's the meme propagation, right? And I mean, I always find it funny when people now, and again, here I wanna be as diplomatic and gentle as I can be. You know, a lot of people who are in their ivory tower will engage in this sort of academic puffery, right? I mean, if your work is known by 3 million people, clearly you're not as pure as me, whose work is only read by two, right? So two people who've read your work is a lot more impressive than 3 million reading your work. And this is a typical phenomenon you see where you have, say, an independent band that plays in their garage or in a venue with only 13 people. When they get their first hit and they become on the Billboard number one, then people say, "What a bunch of sellouts." Right, because as musicians, you don't want to be playing in front of a lot of people. You only want to be playing in front of your mother, right?
That's right. So
there's this academic puffery that I despise, right? I mean, of course do great science and of course publish in the top journals. But of course, it's not exclusive. It's not an either or. Of course, reach out to tons of people who ultimately, at least if you're in a public school, are paying for you to do what you do. So why shouldn't they be consuming your wonderful ideas and discoveries? And so I think this is kind of a really important conversation to have, because I'd really like to, I mean, we do cool stuff. I mean, marketing guide, I mean, not always. Sometimes it's too esoteric and too process-oriented. But I'd like to think that if you're studying consumer behavior, there should be tons of cool stuff that people are dying to hear about. And so hopefully the conversation we're having now, and I mean, one of the things that I'm trying to do with this YouTube channel is to bring tons of interesting people from all walks of life. You're the first marketing professor, but you know, I've had guys who are First Amendment lawyers who are experts. Right? I've had a porn star who's also an engineer who was telling me about the practice of corn, and then I kind of filled in with the evolutionary explanations of pornography.
You know, nobody's listening to you. Right?
No, I was completely invisible. People wrote, "Oh, I didn't even know that you were in this, Professor Saad." I was completely irrelevant to the whole damn thing. But anyways, you know, that's the idea, is that if you are an intellectual, you should be engaging people. And so, you know, for me, anytime I could get the opportunity to learn from somebody, right? I mean, there's obviously tons of stuff that you could teach me that I don't know. I want to have that conversation. And so we need to sort of break down that academic puffery and have people sort of chatting with you. And especially in the context of the forums that we now have, Twitter and Facebook and the YouTube channel. I mean, there are so many ways that today we could disseminate good ideas that, you know, when you and I were doctoral students, we couldn't have imagined this as fantasy, right? So
that's amazing. It's amazing. But one of the really powers of the stuff that you've done, and this is compared to most people's. Most people are you know, they a lot of people I think in academia do either a one and done study, or maybe they do maybe three in the same area and they kind of move on maybe to something else. So as a result, they don't really have, they might do one really cool study, but if you were to have them in an interview situation, or even if they were to be interviewed by a journalist, and the journalist were to ask them anything slightly off of the findings of their study, they wouldn't be able to answer it, right? Because they don't have any view of stuff other than the specific data they have. And I think that ends up being somewhat of a curse, and that people can only stick to a findings of an individual study, and then they run out to another context.
Right, and I think you and I probably both know. I mean, I was a doctoral student at your current school at Cornell, and then I was a visiting professor there in 2000. Yeah. So I got to know who, she's now passed away, Alice Eisen.
Yeah.
And Alice Eisen, and of course, this is not to denigrate her. She's a fantastic psychologist who did who did very important work. But she, in a sense, epitomizes the one focus scientist, right? Because she was, you know, she was profoundly vested in affect research, and so it was sort of affect and fill in the blank, right? Affect and creativity, affect and variety,
memory,
affect and memory. And so, yeah, of course, you think of affect, you're obviously going to think about Alice Eisen. She's done fantastic work, but that's it. I mean, you better have affect in the discussion, otherwise, she's not having that conversation. And from my perspective, again, not to denigrate, that's really not what a true broad intellectual should do. I mean, yes, of course, we've got specialties, but we should be able to sort of be interested in things, you know, beyond our nose, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, you asked a really great question. You said, what's one thing that, a piece of advice that younger people should have? And one of them, I think, is to look at independent variables that actually are manipulatable in the real world. And I know in the case of many of her incredible studies, in fact, I think she's the second most cited person in the entire business school at Cornell. Yeah, it's huge. But almost all of her manipulations where she'd give people a piece of candy, and that would, you know, give them a little bit more affect if they got a candy surprise. And I remember one time asking her, I said, you know, did you ever try to manipulate things other than candy, something that would actually happen in the real world, something that might have relevance? Like, let's say laughing. What happens if somebody laugh during a sales call? How does that change what you're likely to do or whatever? And she says, well, no, I wouldn't study that because it's too confounding in other ways if you laugh at something.
Right.
And I thought, well, that's unfortunate because that is one lever in the real world that is kind of controllable.
Right, exactly.
You're not going to hand a person a piece of candy in the sales meeting. You might try something else.
So basically ecological validity, right? Mundane realism. Yeah. And I think that's sort of the tension that we constantly have in consumer behavior and in marketing. People are wonderful in terms of meeting all the criteria in terms of the internal validity, right? I mean, I've controlled for mood and I ran it here and I controlled for it on Jupiter and I ran it underwater and I ran it over water and there are trees and there's a mediator, there's no, right? Well, you do all that, so boy, you pass all those criteria, and that's wonderful. Of course, it's important to do that. But then what's lost in all this is, how about the external validity? How about the importance of the problem? And I think that's exactly one of the sins that Michel Pham, to come back to him, was talking about, right? I mean, you know, incredibly process-oriented, but then it doesn't lead to much. There's actually a great expression from Arabic, which actually is kind of food-related, which I'd like to mention. I'll say it in Arabic and then translate it in English. So the expression in Arabic is biskaru bil zbibe, which translated literally, it means to get drunk by simply smelling the cork of the wine bottle, right? So you smell the cork and then you go, oh my God, I'm drunk. I'm so drunk, right? And that's what's basically happening with the methodologists, right? They're getting drunk by the rigor and sophistication and internal validity of their methodology. But then the end result, the end problem, it's completely lost. That's why they can't go and speak to the media about how exciting it is, because it's incredibly arcane and not very exciting, the final result. But my God, was it conducted well. And we sort of have to get past that. We have to still have a commitment to methodology, but we've got to look for really the important, exciting problems. right?
Absolutely. And I think that's lost in a lot of cases, because if you start with a problem and look for an answer, you might end up in a journal you otherwise wouldn't want to publish in, they think.
Right.
But by starting with, like, essentially constraining a problem in a way where it can get into one of their target journals, you know, you almost end up with an artificial problem in some cases.
So true. And I know a professor who will remain nameless, who literally teaches his doctoral course with exactly what you just said. It's basically a course that tells you, you know, how do you do moderators and mediators and 2x3x2 so that you get into JCR? Now, I find that preposterous, right? I mean, right? So you're not teaching people how to think. You're teaching how to be good mechanics of science, right? Yeah. How do I sort of artificially construct this paradigm so that it is palatable to the reviewers of journals A and B or C? Now, I don't mean to imply that there aren't career restrictions and people care about getting tenure. Okay, I get that. But ultimately, it doesn't advance our field if we're always doing this game and not really looking for the big problems. I mean, I hope that when people sort of watch our conversation, they take away from it that, you know, we're not trying to just be frivolously critical. On the contrary, it's because we really care about our field, because we know the kind of important works that can be done and the incredible talent that we have coming from all sorts of fields. But yet maybe sometimes we fall short in terms of the problems we tackle.
You know, I had an amazing, I don't want to say life-changing conversation, but like, okay, kind of as close as we get as academics. And then I had had an advisor who is an amazing man who kept me from falling through the cracks, but he really kind of wasn't interested in academic research anymore. And after the age of maybe 40, he started doing books, but he kind of lost that engagement. And as an assistant professor at Dartmouth, and there's a great man coming. He was Donald Lehman.
Was oh, yeah. Name.
Columbia, and at that time he's 55. And the guy was publishing more than any three assistant professors I knew, and he's coming to give a talk at the business school. But there's a blizzard that night, and so all the restaurants are closed. And I said, "Here, we're gonna eat at my house because it's the only place open." So we came over to my house, and we had about 5 hours to eat and drinking. And I asked him this question because it perplexed me why he was so different than my advisor, who I admire so much. I said, "What is it that explains how somebody stays engaged and excited in their 50s and other people don't?" And he had a bunch of ideas, but nothing really specific. And it came around to the idea, and this is powerful. He said, "You know what it is? It's not the kind of university they're at. It's not whether they're at an incredible university or a really small university. It's not whether they're a good teacher or whether they're really charismatic or whether they aren't." He says, "I think the people who stay engaged with research all their life are people who believe their research is having an impact on managers."
Right.
Now, we can revise that when we say people who believe their research is having an impact on somebody other than academics.
Right.
I think that's the bigger way of looking at it. And when you see the response that these video casts get, when you look at when you write a great column for Psychology Today and you get the response, you know, that might be a contributing reason why not only you're so cognitively, you have such a high need for cognition, but how it's directed in a good direction.
Right. Well, that's wonderful. Thank you for including me in that anecdote. Exactly. That's exactly it. I mean, it's almost difficult to not end it here, because it's a very powerful way to sort of end it. Thank you to Don Lehman for this wonderful anecdote. Is there anything else we can add in terms of stuff that you'd like to either promote? I mean, of course, Slim by Design is the latest book. Mindless Eating and all the other books that we mentioned, they should check out. Is there a website that they can people? Maybe I'll put at the bottom of the descriptor.
Sure.
What else? What can you give us so that people can learn more about your work?
Yes, slimbydesign.org. Well, because I think one of the things we do, if we say, okay, I've learned all this stuff, how can I make it very easy to be implemented? That's a huge challenge. It's not something we're very tooled up to do. And I like it in your most recent book when you would do that
right
on occasion, where you'd say, here's what this means in other contexts. And I think the more we can make it usable
right.
by other people, the better. It's not just, like Don said, it's not just people who think their research is having an impact on others. It's people, I think, who then try to make sure that it does have that impact that right. it could have.
Well, and to build on that, before we wrap it up, I mean, I get emails from people from all walks of life, right? I mean, it's not just other academics writing to me, but I mean, I get all sorts of, somebody says, you know, I was reading this part in your paper or in your book, and it helped me understand why I get jealous at my wife. And then this other guy will write to me about something else and another, right? Well, to me, that's incredible. And it's not narcissistic. It's not because I could walk around and say, wow. It's actually incredibly enriching. I'm actually writing something that people are truly using. It's truly having an impact. I mean, beyond my CV. I mean, yes, of course, building a CV is important, but it's beyond that. It's not an artificial game. People really read this stuff and take value from it. And so hopefully, you know, this conversation will, at least for doctoral students, I'm not sure if some of our more senior colleagues will appreciate the conversation as much. Maybe they will. But certainly for the doctoral students, I hope that we've inspired them. Maybe one day they will be saying about your story with Don Lehman, our conversation will be the one that inspired them. So let's wait and see in 20 years what happens. So listen, Brian, what a pleasure. I could keep you here for another 3 hours, but I know you're very busy. So I'm going to stop the recording. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Yeah, and I think just thank you for all you do, my friend.
Oh, you're
wonderful, and it's a great service to a lot of people.
Oh, you're lovely. I'm going to stop it, but stay on the line.